I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of April. We've done several shows in the last 2 months on the growing problem of heroin in our country, and specifically in the state of Wisconsin. The special agent in charge of the Madison office of the Wisconsin Department of Justice, Jim Ingalls, says that heroin has spread like wildfire across the state in the past year and a half. We're seeing it in Madison, Milwaukee, counties to the north, counties in southwest Wisconsin, northwest Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, mid-sized cities, and in our small townships. People charged with robbery are entering jail with drug addictions typically related to their crimes. And in a very good piece in the New York Times on February 10, which looked at heroin addiction in the state of Wisconsin, and which we will post on our Facebook page, these statistics were given. The faces of heroin addiction are getting younger and whiter. 19,154 opioid drug deaths in 2010, and many of those were involving heroin and the rest painkillers. 88% of those who died from heroin were white, half were younger than 33, almost a fifth were ages 15 to 24. Heroin deaths of teenagers and young adults tripled in the first decade of the century. We have three guests with us during the course of this hour. We thought that because we have done shows on the face of heroin addiction in Wisconsin, we also spoke with the former head of the DEA about how drugs are getting into the country. Today, we wanted to speak with recovering addicts, and we'll also speak with a clinical supervisor with Tellurian, which helps people with substance abuse and addictions. Three guests, let me introduce them to you. Jules is joining us from Madison. Jules is 28 years old, is a recovering heroin addict. He has been sober for quite some time now. He's been struggling, though, with heroin addiction since 2003. Big successes in his life recently. He married. He is attending college. And Jules, we thank you very much for joining us to tell us your story. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you here. Becky is also with us. Becky is a college student, a recovering addict who has been sober for 3 years, did self-medication to deal with mental health issues, post-traumatic stress. She has successfully completed 10 months of treatment at Catholic Charities of Madison. Becky, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Becky, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Dr. Greg Matisik. He is clinical supervisor with Tellurian in the adult residential program. And he has been doing lots of work, of course, in this field. He's a professional counselor and does presentations on alcohol and other drug abuse issues. Dr. Matisik, thank you very much for being with us as well. Hi.
Thank you, Kathleen. Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Jules, let's start with you. We're trying to understand the face of addiction this hour of the program. And when I look at your background, you're only 28 years old now, so you must have started using, and what did you first start using when you were in high school, I would imagine?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it sounds so long ago. But in 2003, I was in high school and basically got introduced to, prescription opiates, just kind of as, another drug that teenagers might, sample. And, obviously that just sort of snowballed and, really became hooked on those quite viciously. And then sort of soon after, because a lot of the prescription drugs are actually quite expensive. I mean, a lot more than heroin is. And, after you start sort of, spending all your money, you kind of get introduced somehow to, the more cheaper heroin. And it just kind of snowballs after that.
Mm-hmm. And is this something you mentioned, I think, that this was something that instead of going to marijuana or another kind of drug, that the prescription opiates were something that high school students were experimenting with perhaps more than with other kinds of drugs?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. I mean, especially in my group of friends and even my class, it was a very common thing. Nobody really, thought twice about what exactly these things were. And, obviously experimenting with marijuana, I mean, that was going on. So it was just kind of like another thing. None of us really kind of expected what was going to happen next. So.
Where did you get the opiates?
I think originally it was you know, a friend's mom or something had a prescription. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's probably true for, you know, most heroin users. So.
Mm-hmm. And then heroin was, I don't even know where you would get heroin. It's easy to find heroin in Wisconsin, in Madison?
You know, yeah, somehow. Is. You just sort of, you know, when you're hanging out with that type of crowd, you know, stuff starts to become available. So, you know, it's a lot easier than you think when you actually want to look for it.
Yeah. Becky, you have said that you were self-made medicating. You obviously went through a painful childhood.
I did, yeah.
What happened?
I just had a really abusive home. My dad was physically, verbally, and sexually abusive. Oh. And, you know, I feel like it's, what happened to me, I feel like it's normal. Like, a lot of people would probably self-medicate at that point. And opiates, lo and behold, are like the perfect numbing agent. You know, you're rather oblivious to, you know, life in general. You just, it's a fix-all drug for someone in my circumstances or my situation. So I think that's kind of just where everything stems from.
So you don't feel the pain, you don't remember the abuse that you suffered. When you say things are different, you glide through life,
exactly.
You're not aware of pain.
Exactly. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's just, it literally numbs everything, and you just kind of forget what's real and what's not, because everything just blurs together. And it literally is a fix-all drug, in my opinion. I should say, in my opinion, you know, that's how I feel about it.
And where did you get the opiates?
So my dad had a really bad back, and he was prescribed Oxycontins. And I would steal them from him. He would give them to me, you know, kind of just like a, here, you can have this, you know, just to shut me up, basically. So that's where that had originated from.
And did you subsequently go into heroin as well or not?
Oh, absolutely. He had ended up going to prison, and, you know, I had this unbelievable, like, just hunger for this opiate, you know what I mean? And it wasn't there, wasn't available anymore. But, you know, as Jules had said, you run with that crowd, you know, you kind of meet new people. Well, at one point I just couldn't find what I wanted. I couldn't find the prescription drugs anymore. So I had shifted my focus to heroin, which was cheaper in the beginning. It sure was. And it was so available everywhere I looked.
Really?
I'd find it.
Mm.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. More people that I knew, most of them had access to it. Even if they didn't do it, it was available.
Mm-hmm. Jules, at what point did you say, that's it, I can't do this anymore?
Oh, I mean, many times. You know, I told the producer here, it says, you know, my friends would kind of get annoyed by me, because every time we would get high or something like that, I'd always sort of talk about, you know, getting clean, and they were kind of sick of me all the time, you know. But I think, you know, you run, you know, right to rock bottom. You know, the old cliche, it's just, you're broke, your friends and family, you know, don't want to support you anymore. And you kind of just realize that it's, you know, it's not sustainable. If you want, you know, more things out of life, you know, you can't just keep doing the same thing. And it's a really hard moment, because, you know, you obviously, you have an attachment to the drug. I mean, it makes you feel good. But I think, you know, when it comes down to it, you just sort of, you can't do it anymore, because you're going to end up on the streets, you know, or worse. And so, you know, I think that moment came to me many times. And I tried to get better lots of times, and I would stumble, but I kind of always had that desire to get better at some point, and I think that definitely helped me.
Mm-hmm. How did you pay for the drugs? You were very young.
You know, any means necessary. You know, I hope my folks, you know, maybe are listening, but, you know, yeah, I would do, you know, sort of whatever I had to do, and, you know, stealing, obviously, mm-hmm. and, you know, just trying to do as any means necessary, really.
And how about you, Becky? When did you decide that's it?
You had kind of mentioned that somebody had told you that, you know, people were getting arrested for robberies and, you know, drug-related crimes. Well, I was one of those people. I was incarcerated for an armed robbery that I had done under the influence. I was, you know, I went into a gas station and I had committed that awful crime so I could have just one more fix. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, just some more drugs in general. It didn't even matter because you're so horrified of being, you know, in withdrawal from this drug. So while I was incarcerated, my attorney had come to me and she said, look, I can get you out, but it's going to be, you know, to go straight to an inpatient treatment center. And it wasn't in Madison. It was, you know, in Oconomowoc. So I agreed because I was like, hey, I'll get out of jail and I'll just, you know, do whatever I have to do to get these people off my back, and then I'm going to go get high. Well, while I was in the inpatient, I mean, I had absolutely no desire to be clean. I kind of looked at it like I'm going to die from this.
Really?
And absolutely. I had accepted the fact that I was probably going to overdose at some point, and I was, you know, I wasn't going to make it. So while I'm in treatment, I had my moment of clarity. I heard the birds chirping for the first time, and I couldn't tell you how many years. And it was really a joyful moment. And I said, I can do this. I want this. And I just had that, I don't know, just that drive to want something better for my life, to do something. And I've been clean ever since.
Mm. And did you have a similar experience at all, Jules, that you felt that you might die of this as well, or did you not think that?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I think anyone using heroin kind of, you know, sort of mm-hmm. understands the risk that you're running. And, you know, you're just kind of getting progressively, you know, more, I don't know the word, but just kind of like, you know, dangerous. You're just sort of pushing the limits more and more and mm-hmm. more. And so, you know, yeah, I had, you know, countless, not quite friends, but, you know, acquaintances that, you know, I saw pass away.
Oh.
And, yeah, you know, and jail and other things like that. And so, you know, again, it's just kind of, you sort of realize that this is just not going to sustain me. This is not really what I want for my life, you know. I want, you know, I've got goals. And I think also, too, again, you know, a big thing for me was just kind of realizing the relationship with my good, you know, high school friends and the friends that I truly valued, as well as my family, kind of those relationships deteriorating. And so, you know, I think it happened for me kind of, you know, a few times, probably, you know, 2005 and 2007 and sort of progressive other, you know, other times like that. And
You mentioned the withdrawal, Becky, and I want to hear from both of you because we hear mm-hmm. about how hard that is, and the doctor will tell us about some new treatments that seem to be quite effective. But what is that like? Why is it such a painful thing that you really can't stand it? Becky?
There's like cold sweats, you're vomiting, you have diarrhea, you can't eat, you can't sleep, your skin is like, it just feels like you're crawling out of your skin, your bones hurt. You can't die from a heroin withdrawal, but you want to.
Oh.
You can't get warm no matter what you do. It's just, it's awful. Experience of it, I'll never forget it in the rest of my life. I'll never forget how it felt to just not being able to do anything because I need to be high to get in the shower. I need to be high to eat. And if you don't have that, guess what? You're not eating. Guess what? You're not showering. You aren't doing anything else because it's just, it consumes so much of you. The better half of you is what it consumes. And it just leaves you damaged physically, mentally, emotionally. And I think that when I was in withdrawal, it wasn't necessarily just the physical aspect that I just was making it even worse. I mean, the emotional aspect of it, I mean, it's just awful because you're just irritable. You're a mess, just all over, just all across the board. You are just a mess. You're falling apart.
And how long does it take for that to pass, Becky, or does that vary from person to person?
You know, that I honestly can't give you an answer, but I know that for me, it depends on what my tolerance was. In the beginning, it was maybe a day or two, but then towards the end, it was like a day or two to start withdrawing full force. Uh-huh. Like you would yawn and you would be tired. And then after that first 24 hours, I mean, it was full force, ill, just ill.
Jules, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, she kind of hit it on the head there. You know, for me, you know, brought back memories. The crawling out of the skin was just god-awful. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, you would be sitting in bed, you know, so tired because you want to sleep, but you can't get comfortable. I mean, you just literally feel like, you know, something inside of you just wants to, like, crawl out of your body. And so it's just awful, you know. And, yeah, you can't... you know, you can't get warm. You can't, you know, you can't cool down. You're sweating and you're super cold. And then also, yeah, the after effects, the mental stuff, you know, the depression and sort of just feeling worthless. Like, you know, you can't do this. There's no way. You know, it's just, it's kind of like, you know, all these things at once. So it's such a large mountain at the time, you know, and it just feels, you feel so hopeless. So, you know, the physical stuff is really just, it's awful. But then, you know, you kind of add in some of the mental stuff and, you know, it's a double, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dr. Matisek, let me introduce you again here for a moment. There are certain drugs on the market now that will help people who are trying to kick the habit, keep them from having to undergo some of the most severe symptoms of withdrawal, aren't there?
Yeah. First of all, I wanted to say congratulations to both Jules and Becky on your sobriety. Heroin is a really tough drug to kick. And what we're finding is because it's so physiologically addictive that one of the typically in the past, people have used methadone, mm-hmm. but they're using it less and less because it can be taken not every day, but people can sell it and can still get high off the methadone. But the key drug that's been out lately is Suboxone,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure probably both of you are familiar with that. Mm-hmm. Suboxone essentially is an opiate, but it attaches to the opiate receptors, which means that if you're continuing to take it, then if you do take heroin or other opiates, you can't get high. And so it helps to relieve the physical cravings. But both Jules and Becky, you know, they're really good examples of what we see all the time in treatment is that with any drug, you still want to take a look at the psychological and emotional components that you need to address as well.
Oh, I'm sure you have to do a lot of therapy, don't you?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing we're seeing is that oftentimes, as you guys both mentioned, people take drugs to feel better and to not deal with painful emotions. And one of the things we do in treatment is encourage people to start recognizing emotions and start to feel them and get support from healthy individuals that can be around you to kind of sense, you know, what's going on with you and if you're agitated and patterns so that you can start to address those before going to use a drug is something that people entertain.
Doctor, I mentioned at the top of the show the face of heroin addiction getting younger and whiter. Do you see that in the work that you do, and can you explain why that's happening?
Well, you know, I agree with what both Jules and Becky are saying and what you said initially, except that we have seen it for the last 5 years, not the last year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we've sensed that the media has caught on to it the last year and a half. And quite simply, it's what Jules started off to say. For whatever reason, in the high school setting, prescription drugs, in particular drugs like OxyContin and oxycodone, people start taking them, and they're pretty expensive, you know, like sometimes almost $80 a pill.
Ooh.
And unfortunately, heroin's about $10 a bag. And so eventually when people get hooked on opiates, it just makes logical sense. I can't afford to pay for these pills, but I can do heroin.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, I don't know if you guys were intravenous users or not, but people have a difficult time believing this, but in the work I've been here Tulane for 8 years, I haven't met a heroin user that started off liking needles. but most of them will eventually go to using needles because it's quicker and faster. But it doesn't mean they ever wanted to do it. It just is kind of a unfortunate a consequence in that direction when people have been using.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for all of our guests, and let me give you our phone number. We're talking about heroin addiction this hour of the program. We've done several shows on how all of these drugs are getting into the country, mostly through Mexico. You know, because there's been a lot of reporting, including a Wisconsin Public Radio series on how widespread heroin is in the state of Wisconsin. New York Times February 10 article, we've put it on our Facebook page, the Kathleen Dunn Show, which looks at a mother who lost her daughter to an overdose and looks at the face of addiction here in the state of Wisconsin. But we thought we wanted to speak with people who have been through treatment, who were addicts, who have come out on the other side and who struggled, as you can hear from both Jules and Becky, for a long time with their addiction. We also wanted to speak with someone who knows what kinds of treatment options there are and what is most effective. And we also wanted to speak with you. Our phone number for Becky and Jules and Dr. Matisic, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now as we talk about heroin addiction this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jeff in Eau Claire is our first caller. Hey, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
It's going to be pretty hard for me, but I lost a friend at the end of February, and we went back just about 30 years.
Oh.
And I just wanted to tell the guests that I'm really proud of them. And I hope you can help some people. That's it.
Thank you for the call. Jules, you want to respond?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's, you know, unfortunately, that's, you know, sort of the venue that we're in here. And I think a lot of times, you know, even if you aren't actually using yourself, I think there's countless people who can say that they've witnessed someone struggling, and so I think that's a big issue here, that not only this is not only about the addicts, but it's about the family and friends who have to witness a loved one going down that road, and unfortunately death is a big part of this epidemic. So, I really feel for you, because I've seen some close people, fall down those paths. And so, it's just heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. And Becky, I would imagine you have as well.
Yeah, actually, I lost my significant other about a year ago.
Oh.
And It was really, really awful. It was just those, I feel like when we use as addicts, I feel like our families use with us, obviously not physically, but emotionally, just that emotional roller coaster that we experience, well, they experience it as well, just because of the toll that our actions take on them. So when I lost him, it was like, you're left with these feelings like you're torn. Like, I'm so glad that I made it, but I'm so sad that my friend didn't. And I've lost a lot of people along the way. My friends are in prison. It's a devastating piece of life that's happening right now, that people are just, everything is in shambles, and we don't know how to stop it. We don't know how to help them. We don't know what we're doing. The only thing we can do is kind of pull back and just watch this destructive path happen, and it's so sad when you lose these people along the way. But as Jewel said, it comes with the territory, it doesn't make it right. I'm not saying that it's something that you should just be like, oh, it's no big deal. It's a huge deal. But at the same time, we have to accept the fact that this kind of stuff does happen, especially IV users.
Yeah.
They overdose all the time. And, you know, it's devastating, the toll that it is taking on everybody around those individuals that don't
right.
make it.
Right. Dr. Matisik, give us an understanding of this. In my family, there's been alcoholism to the point where a dear uncle, you know, left his family and wound up on Skid Row in Chicago. And I loved him dearly, and others in the family did and tried to save him. And I could to this day. And maybe everybody can help us. There are people in our lives, even if our lives have been rough ones, like Becky's has, who love us dearly and who would do anything, anything in the world for us to help us come out on the other side. Why does that seem to be not effective? That true, deep love and a desire to help sometimes just isn't enough.
You know, the bottom line is research continues to change, but in the last 10 to 15 years, as we've had PET scans, we realize that this tends to be what we would call a brain disease. So, for example, if somebody had cancer, there may or may not be some genetic predisposition, but also sometimes how we take care of ourselves, the foods we eat, the rest we get can influence those things. And what people still struggle to understand is they think that it's a choice, and it may be a choice to actually take drugs or consume alcohol, but once you're addicted, it's no longer a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes this compulsion that takes you over. And so I think what's so difficult about it is families just are, you know, devastated, and they're wanting to help, and they sometimes get involved in things that they think are beneficial, but it basically makes their lives miserable. And you know, and so one of the things I always tell people is that in order for addicts to get better, they have to work really hard at how to take care of themselves. But if I want other people in my life to get better, I really have to do the same thing, just take care of myself, because I can't control what other people are going to do. One of the things that's important for the population who's listening today to understand, just like Alcoholics Anonymous has groups like Al-Anon, there is for Narcotics Anonymous, a similar 12-step program, a group called Narcanon. And it's really important that families get the support that they need, like both Jules and Becky mentioned today.
Mm-hmm. Becky, I don't think I've asked you, what kind of treatment program worked for you? Were you on were you on a substitution of some kind? Are you on something now that keeps you clean?
So I did my, I shouldn't laugh because this is no laughing matter. I'm just kind of chuckling because looking back on it, it's like, oh my gosh, you know. So I had done methadone, and it was probably one of the worst things that I've ever done, trying to get clean. I did inpatient treatment. I did intensive outpatient treatment. I tried Suboxone. And ultimately what it was is I needed to heal, like, me without any medications, because I was running out of options. There was no meds that I could take to stop these cravings, these urges. I needed to figure out what was going on internally and fix that, because that's what it took. So, I mean, I tried a handful of things, and lo and behold, all I needed was somebody to hold my hand when I didn't know how to do it on my own.
Hmm. Let's go to Sean in Fond du Lac. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Well, first, two comments. Number one, what an outstanding show, and how brave you guys are to tell your story, especially with mom and dad potentially, you know, listening and family and friends on the phone. So applause to you. This is such an important thing to get out. My question is for the physician on the call. I work in pharmacogenomics, a discipline of genetics that looks at how patients respond to certain medications, and we have tests that look at genes that encode for those opiate receptors, specifically one of them, the mu receptor. And so we can predict at a certain level of efficacy whether or not, even if that substance reaches the site of action, the brain, whether or not that patient will see response, meaning a chronic pain patient. One of the questions I get over and over again, and when we do research, or we look at the data that's out there from peer-reviewed publications, the questions we get from chronic pain physicians is, are there any genetic predisposition markers that tell me whether or not these people who are treating for chronic pain with these opioid medications are more predisposed to become addicts and then eventually, you know, get labeled as drug seekers and then kind of follow a different route than you folks have followed, which is then they go to the streets and look for heroin or something because they've kind of been blackballed in the system. And so some of the things that I've heard in the literature, but I don't think it's anywhere validated yet, is that folks who have, you know, aberrations in their genetic code for these receptors where they don't bind quite efficiently to the active molecule,
mm-hmm.
Potentially, therefore, they will take more medication to try to achieve that pain relief,
mm-hmm.
whether it's chronic pain or just emotional pain from, you know, their lifestyle or what's been going on in their life. So I'm just curious if you have any feedback.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Thank you. Dr. Matisic.
Yeah, I wanted to be upfront. I'm a PhD, not an MD. And so I'm a therapist, but not a medical doctor. But I'm aware of some of the research you're talking about, and it seems to me like it's just in that process where they're still trying to figure that out. Everything seems to be more in hindsight after you've taken a look at somebody who's been using for a while and the PET scans showing the changes that are occurring in the brain. So what you're talking about is fascinating, and I think the hope is in the field of addiction that they are going to be able to find out genetically if people do have predispositions.
Thank you so much for the call, Sean. Phyllis in Antigo, Wisconsin. Hi.
Yes. My grandson lives out in Washington State. When I talk to him, now I believe he's been on heroin for about 3 years. He's been off and on and off and on. And the last I've heard, he's off. But when I talk to him on the phone, he just says, oh, I'm not the same, Grandma. And he sounds, his speech is different, and it's as if he has a type of brain disturbance. And I'm wondering if he can get off and does get off, if this brain disturbance will come back to its normal.
Phyllis, do you ever see him?
I do not.
Okay.
I'm 85 years old. I cannot get out to him.
Right.
I would love to. But I do talk to him, and we've always been very close. So when I talk to him, I always feel that he is being very honest with me.
Mm-hmm. Jules, let's go to you before we go to the doctor on this, and also to Becky. Do you feel as though you're as sharp as you were before you started using drugs?
Yeah, actually, well, you know, that was one of the things that worried me greatly after I had fallen, you know, addicted, was just that, yeah, I didn't feel like, you know, I was kind of my old self, and I was worried if I would ever, you know, sort of gain the way I would, you know, look at things and be able to, you know, analyze things like I did before. And, you know, it worried me, you know, deeply, even to the point where I was clean for some years and I still had no direction as to what I wanted to do. So I really spent a lot of time kind of just, you know, worried about that. Like, I couldn't succeed even if I wanted to go to school. I had been out of school for so long. So, I'm not smart enough. All these young bucks are going to be, you know, doing laps around me. But what I found was, you know, that just wasn't the case. I was able to, you know, a lot of the anxiousness I had about school and, you know, whether or not I could succeed was really just, you know, a product of, you know, a natural fear. You know, it had nothing really to do, at least in my, you know, experience, it had nothing to do with, you know, my prior addiction. It was kind of just overcoming that, you know, that next step, going to school, as any, you know, non-addict would probably be nervous about doing. I was able to sort of overcome that, and you know, I personally don't feel like there's any negative repercussions that way mentally, but I can't say for sure.
And that's probably true for you, Becky. You're in college now, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
And you're doing all right?
I'm any normal college student. You know, I do really great on some things, and some things I'm like, oh, no, that's not my strong point.
I understand that, yeah. So I think that's probably true of all of us.
Yeah, I think, so Jules is absolutely right. You know, I had a lot of anxiety about certain things. But what I did notice about myself was while I was actively using, it was almost like I just couldn't remember anything. And things just weren't firing right for my brain, I feel like, because I couldn't remember to spell. I've always been a really excellent speller. That is one of my strongest points when it comes to school. There were certain things that I could not accomplish the way I can now. Like, I know when I look at a word, it's not spelled right, something looks odd, you know, and before I was just like, I was oblivious to it. And I'm not sure that if it was just me being oblivious because the drugs kept me that way, or if something cognitively really was going on to where I was like, not delayed, but you know, something just wasn't firing right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just for me, my experience. I don't know how it is for anyone else.
Yeah. And let's address Phyllis, Dr. Matisic. Here she is, 85 years old, can't get out to see her grandson, hears something different in his voice. I mean, that breaks your heart.
It does break your heart. And one of the tough things is we don't know if he's still using or not. It would certainly make sense if he's using a lot of what Becky and Jules are talking about, is that there's a lot of research showing that people have short-term memory loss, and they're just not able to do things in the way they would normally. There's no question. But even beyond that, once you first initially get in recovery, it can take anywhere from 3 to 6 months for people to stabilize. And for some people, it takes up to a year before they start feeling better. Part of that is the brain's this fascinating thing that it releases dopamine for normally naturally pleasurable events. And in a way, when you're giving it drugs on a regular basis, it goes, I don't need to release as much dopamine. I'm getting it from this outside source. So once you start getting clean and stop taking the drug, the brain's kind of depleted of this dopamine from the limbic system. And you have this sense, which we call anhedonia, which is a fancy word for even the simple things in life just don't make you very happy. You feel kind of blah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like almost a dysthymia. And it can take a while for people to come out of that. And for people who use for years, it's almost like playing Russian roulette. You don't know how long it's going to take for somebody to come out of that, if they ever would. Most people, by and large, the brain's an amazing thing that can heal itself, but you've got to stop using and then go through that process for it to recover.
Thank you, Phyllis. I hope you can see your grandson. Let's go to Lynn in Eau Claire. Hi.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guests. I lost a brother a little over a year ago, suicide by alcohol. Took him 5 years. I held his hand when he passed over. And I'm a chronic pain patient. But there's a big difference between Patrick and myself. I find so much joy in everyday little things. I use my medication wisely. I use it to not mask the pain, because, I mean, I'm a Buddhist also. First noble truth is there is pain, but some days it doesn't let me be me, and then I'll use pain medication. Patrick couldn't face life at all. He didn't have the wisdom. He was beautiful and talented and athletic and a teak, and he was amazing, but there was nothing there. There was no wisdom to bind it together. And my experience with Pat was that his life was a lie. I'm not drinking, I'm not drinking vodka. I'm only drinking beer or wine. And it's like there's no difference. And I knew that, and he knew that, and we all knew that. And we all asked, why weren't we enough? And it doesn't make any difference, and we're not guilty. There's no guilt.
Mm. Dr. Matisic, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think you've got a good attitude. As painful as it is, and it's incredibly painful to see people around you where they're at and maybe not able to change. And my experience has been with something like this, it's kind of like trying to cure cancer or heart disease by yourself. You know, nobody can do that. And addiction is also a condition, a disease that you need the assistance of other people. But one of the things we talk about, and we do have at least 2 family sessions a week for people who are in treatment, so we can talk with family members about how important it is for you to take care of yourself. There's no question, because I think by doing that, we really give the people around us hope.
And let me go to Becky and to Jules on this as well. I know, Becky, you had a troubled childhood, but I'm sure there was somebody, and maybe still is, somebody, and I hope more than one person, who really loves you and who's been rooting for you and helpful to you. Was that ever something that you seriously considered, or did the drug overtake everything?
Absolutely not. I mean, I do have so many people in my life that have always cared for me and always wanted to help me. You know, it's like that helplessness. They don't know how to help me.
Right.
And ultimately, there is nothing that they can do. Like I said earlier, is I never thought about any of them when I was, you know, running around using drugs, doing all these risky behavioral things. You know, I was a walking mess. I would always kind of, my sister and I are extremely close, and if I were to feel guilt about anything, about it was her, looking in her face and knowing how badly I hurt her. She's the one person now that holds my hand and has always held my hand when I needed her to. But ultimately, was she enough to make me stop using?
No.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Nobody was. Nothing was going to make me stop except me.
Yeah. Jules, how about you?
Yeah, you know, that's very similar to me. I mean, you know, you feel so badly, you know, that you're kind of watching yourself lie, you know, to the ones that you love the most. And it's a terrible feeling, you know. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, they've sort of been there for you, but you just kind of, you're just so hooked, and that's really tough. But, you know, one of the things that I think is really important is for, you know, friends and family to kind of understand, you know, support can be different things. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, I think, you know, one type of support, which, you know, can lead to enabling, that's not quite, you know, the way to go about it. You know, at least in my case, it was really just the support, you know, of being able to talk to them and be open and let them know, look, you know, I messed up this time, but, you know, I'm really trying to do this better. You know, that was a big thing for me. But, you know, I think ultimately, as Becky said, you know, you've got to do it yourself. And so it really helps when you have the friends and family. But you know, you got to do the heavy lifting. It's not easy. But I think it's, you know, if I can do it, you know, anyone can do it. And so I just think, you know, you've got to kind of come to a realization that, you know, this is what you want to do. You want to get out of it. And if friends and family can be there to support you positively, that's just all the better.
Mm. Well, we'll take more phone calls in a moment. We've done a series of programs on heroin addiction, and we thought it important to hear from people who were addicted and who are recovering. And so that's what we're doing this hour, in addition to speaking with Greg Masick, who's a clinical supervisor with Tellurian, an adult in the adult residential program. And he, his PhD is in, from UW-Madison, in human ecology, and he's been working in this field, doing presentations and working with people who are suffering from addictions for some time. Becky is with us. Becky is now a college student, a recovering addict who has been sober for 3 years, and sounds like she went through hell for a good portion of her life. Jules is with us. He is a recovering heroin addict. He is 28 years old. He struggled with addiction since 2003, so he was very young. He has recently been married, and he is attending college as well. Here's our phone number. A couple lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Wednesday, we'll be talking about a pretty interesting issue. We all know that CEOs make a lot more than rank-and-file employees. As a matter of fact, the 10 most highly paid chief executives in this country took home more than $100 million each in pay, shares, and stock options last year. The average family income, $51,017. So we're going to look at this disparity between the CEOs and the average rank and file worker and why it is that way more so than it ever has been, and whether you need that for companies to be truly competitive or if it makes workers feel put upon and more likely to call in sick and not work as hard. So our guest is from London, and she was chair of the Independent High Pay Commission. She is the former business editor of The Guardian and has written extensively about executive pay and other business issues. All right, we go back to phone calls for our guests, and Alan has been waiting in Madison. Hi, Alan. Hi, Alan.
Hi. My name is Alan Nyberg. I'm with a group called Young People in Recovery, and first of all, I just wanted to thank both of you very much for sharing your story. I'm a person in recovery as well, and it took me quite a while to become comfortable with talking about it publicly, so I want to thank you both for sharing your stories. And I know that when I was kind of in the grips of addiction and I was trying to get clean, I didn't want to admit it because there was such a stigma associated with being a drug addict or being an alcoholic. And I guess my question is that one of the most popular support groups is 12-step based here in town, and I noticed that sometimes the principles of anonymity that they carry is kind of detrimental, because a lot of people won't speak publicly about their addiction or their alcoholism, and that's the way I see it. And so I guess my question is, do you think the 12-step programs are detrimental to the stigma associated with alcoholism and addiction?
Becky, let's start with you.
I personally, I did the 90 and 90 when I first got out of treatment, so I know, you know, what takes place in AA, and I also did fair share of NA. I personally don't, it's rather clicky, I feel, and it was not healthy for me to be. I felt unaccepted. I felt like because I was a heroin addict in an AA group that I wasn't quite the same. As far as like the anonymity, I've yet to find a real true 12-step group that doesn't break that in some way, shape, or form. And I do think that it feeds into a stigma that we live by. You know, with as an addict, I already know that I'm labeled the rest of my life as a recovering addict. But to keep it in a closet, in a secret, well, secrets keep you sick. That's what they teach you in treatment. So I'm really kind of with Alan on this one. I think that it kind of does feed into that. But I also know that here in Madison, there are a ton of great programs. Like there's Smart Recovery, there's Connections. I know Tolarian has a good little program going on there. Catholic Charities, the program that I went through, was really, really great. You know, there's a ton of options. You don't just have to be, you know, stuck with AA or NA or, you know, something of that nature.
All right. Thanks, Alan. I give everybody else a chance to respond, but we have a lot of calls and just a couple of minutes left. So let's go to Nick in McFarland. Hi, Nick.
Hi. I'd like to thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to speak about this, I feel, important issue. I'm a heroin user. I've been using for 4 years. I've had stints of clean time and, you know, relapses. I was clean for 9 or 10 months up until a couple months ago. And it kind of seems to me, you know, like it gets harder after you relapse more and more, especially in a short amount of time, and how it affects your family and kids. And I just have a question for the doctor about what's the best way of going about trying to stop the,
okay,
you know, the short-term relapses.
Okay.
Well, boy, I really appreciate your call, and I'm sorry for your struggle. And as you know, there tends to be this sense that if you stop and you go back to it, it's almost like you never left. It's almost like there's this sense of brain memory we're finding, and that's where a lot of dangerous overdoses can occur. People may be sober for a few months, and then all of a sudden when they start using again, they start taking the same amount they took when they were using, and the body has reduced its tolerance level, so people can overdose and ultimately die from those things.
And we're almost out of time. So.
Yeah. So I guess what I'd say is now you know too much. You know your struggle with this, and as soon as you can to try to reach out for help, the better, because and then just let people assist you.
Yeah. All the best to you, Nick. Thank you all so much for being with us. Becky and Jules, for your total honesty and information, thank you. I hope you have great lives. Thank you.
Glad to come.
Yeah. And Dr. Greg Matisik, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
We will do another show on this. Milwaukee's having a major conference on heroin use and treatment in June. So at the end of May, we'll be doing another program that will center on treatment programs and effective treatments for addiction. Thanks to Marika Saval for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up. We'll return.